Blog Talk Radio.
Our roots began in Africa, where we enjoyed self-determination and freedom, which were rooted in our sovereignty. Peace, family. Welcome to Dare to Win, the Us Lifting Us weekly radio program that airs every Thursday evening from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Dare to Win is the place where we have sobering conversations about the economic plight of Black people and the imperative that we build the global economic machinery that will free us and once again put us on the path of making history. We at Us Lifting Us have developed an exact methodology on how to build this global machinery and pass it forward to our children and future generations. To join tonight's conversation, please call 929-477-2789, the number one on your phone when you want to make a comment or ask a question. If you prefer to listen on your computer, go to www.usliftingus.com, scroll down to the bottom of the homepage, click on the Dare to Win button, then click on Listen Live. At that time, you will be on the Blog Talk Radio site. If you want to get reminders from Blog Talk Radio for upcoming Dare to Win programs, click on the Follow button. ULU members, we have our own social media community. Please join if you have not already done so. There is a Dare to Win group And we would like to have your feedback on past Dare to Win programs, as well as topic suggestions for future programs. I am Sister Q, and joining me for this evening's discussion is Brother Shabaka, who, like me, is a member of UNU. This evening's topic is, how is the plebiscite movement connected to Black liberation? Peace, Brother Shabaka. How are you doing tonight?
Peace to you, sister. I'm doing fine. I'm eager to get into the topic, and thank you for asking. And greetings to the family members who are attending on the air. Welcome your participation as well.
Thank you, Brother Shabaka. Let's begin tonight's discussion by defining plebiscite for the family.
Yeah, thank you, sister, for that. And I will be very happy to lend my view and my understanding of plebiscite. But I have to give credit to Dr. Imari Abubakari Obadeli. He was one of the founders of the Republic of New Africa, the provincial government for the Republic of New Africa. And along with himself and others, particularly those coming from the National Conference of Black Lawyers, eventually created the formation of the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America, which we today call NCOBRA, or which was then called NCOBRA. Also, in 1991, a few years after the formation of NCOBRA, a conference was called. That conference primarily was to deal with strategies to try to save Black males, Black family, and the Black community.
Mm-hmm.
It was at that conference. Now, this isn't the first time that plebiscite has been talked about. All right, but it was at that conference when she began to talk about plebiscite, particularly in the context of reparation. But to get down to its basic concept, we can look at a plebiscite as a direct vote. A direct vote now, in other words, it's something that is organized by the state as a consequence of pressure from its citizens. A plebiscite would be defined as a direct vote of all qualified people. That's very important. You know, not everybody is qualified to participate. All right, so you have to be qualified to participate in this particular vote on some measure. All right, and usually that measure is centered around, you know, recently independence or maybe even a change in the government structure or operation. All right, so they call people there, all right, to do this. Very much closely tied to that is referendum. And for our sake, I'll just define a referendum as a up or down vote, again, by qualified voters on some law which a legislature, that is the body that is responsible for passing laws, has passed, all right? Such law cannot go into effect unless the people, these are the qualified people, approve it in election. All right. Such an election is called a referendum. Now, what NCOBRA and other people did around the early 1990s at this particular conference was to bring the two together. So when we look at within the framework of a referendum, all right, a reparations plebiscite can be thought of as some direct vote by qualified voters on a law passed by a state, somebody, all right, or a federal legislature, in this case could be the Congress, on the right, listen to this, the right to separate from that state or the U.S., or integrate as full-body citizens into that state or the U.S., or we use the term repatriate to the African continent, but really a sister corrected me and said, we want not repatriation, we want rematriation. He said, we're not going to the fatherland, we're going to the motherland. So therefore, okay. We go to the motherland, we're going to rematriate.
Okay.
All right, to the okay. African continent. And I go along with that, all right, because I don't think of Africa as the fatherland. Like some people in Europe or Germany in particular think of Germany as the fatherland. It's the motherland. Uh-huh. All right. Again, from the referendum framework, such a law cannot go into effect unless approved by qualified voters in an election. And all right, so in order to have the plebiscite, all right, in the framework of a referendum, you have to have an election. All right, and in having that election, all right, depending on the outcome, the state is obligated, all right, because it's law, all right, because it was mm-hmm. it was passed, it's law to carry out the dictates of that law. So in that context, we begin to see where plebiscite has a political orientation, and that political orientation was to deal with subjugation of people of African descent, you know, in this country, and they were trying to express, you know, some remediation of that subjugation. Uh-huh. All right, but they were trying to do that by going to the state or the federal apparatus.
I have a question. When you say qualified voter, mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. would be let's say it was the people of New York that were going to vote on this, if I'm understanding you correctly. Okay, so the people in New York are going to vote on this. When you say qualified voters to vote on this, this is all the people that live in New York, or just the black folks in New York that have, let's say, a horse in the race, you know, that this particular matter pertains to, or is an open general election?
Very good question. Yeah, very good question. The qualified people in this case who benefit from the that particular law, if passed, would be black. So only the blacks, all right, would be open to participation, which is why it's a plebiscite, and I said I put it in the context of a referendum, which would include probably all of the citizens. But the plebiscite okay. is only to address the people who have a grievance, all right, and have expressed an opportunity to voice that grievance, and they want to have it through a plebiscite. Now, a plebiscite is sanctioned by the United Nations, and the United States
okay.
is a member of the United Nations. Okay. All right. But now what has happened, you know, it's only very few that are, particularly in the case of black folks, all right,
uh-huh.
is that the United States they abide by, you know, what we call treaties, all right.
Okay.
And there are certain things that they buy into emanating from the United Nations, okay? The treaties would have to be approved by Congress, because it means then that the Congress, all right, and the executive, which would be the president, would then have to enforce the treaty on the citizens, even though the citizens were not responsible for making the treaty, all right? All right, so that's it. All right. The treaty comes to the United States. The executive would then have to take it over to the Congress. The Congress is essentially representatives of the people, so-called.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We know how that is. All right. And then they would have to bring it up, all right, and vote on it. And then if the treaty is voted on, then the executive would be responsible to enforce the treaty, all right, whatever the provisions is, on the citizens of the United States, because indirectly the citizens of the United States, all right, gave approval to the Congress, who are representing them, all right, to accept the treaty. But usually we know that doesn't work all the time, but that's the way it's supposed to work. It doesn't do that all the time. Consequently, in this term, with respect to this plebiscite, to go back to your question that you originally asked, is that the qualified voters in this case would be the people who are affected by the plebiscite being approved or not approved, okay? And mm-hmm. so, therefore, since this is dealing with reparations, a person like Trump would not be invited to participate.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you for that explanation.
Right.
Okay, so will you continue, because we're trying to get terms together so everybody will be on the same page. Will you mm-hmm. define black liberation and then tell us how the two, plebiscite and black liberation, connect?
Well, thanks again for those two questions, sister. Black liberation basically came out the black liberation theology. You know, the black church has played an extremely important role, you know, in a lot of the political movement, you know. Mm-hmm. Regardless of what your ideological persuasions are, regardless of how you feel about the black church, regardless of, you know, how you're saying your view of the black preacher, the black church has played an important aspect in resistance to the subjugation that we are experiencing, and even to the point of, you know, pushing for full citizenship. You might say, well, now, why is this? Remember now, the brutality of the slave system was such, you know, that, you know, you worked from sun up to sundown and beyond, all right, and you were given meager, all right, rations in order to sustain yourself. Well, the Europeans at that time thought interdependent, this is not wholly consistent throughout the period we call slavery, all right, mm-hmm. because with the trade, all right, some Europeans thought we had an inexhaustible supply of Africans. All right, so therefore they could treat them as brutal as they want. All right, there was a pleasant supply. Others, from an economic standpoint, say, well, look, I got to treat them a little bit decent, you know, because I had to pay, you know, $500, you know, for that black male. Now, which was, mm-hmm. and they paid that amount of money. That's big money. Though you figure that right. in the 17 and 1800s, $500 was very big money, okay,
uh-huh.
all right, to pay. Uh-huh. So therefore, that was an investment. That investment you got, and that's in the business world today, is that if you pay $500, you see that the worth that that person can bring to you goes beyond $500, all right? So therefore, you want to be able to matriculate and double and triple that amount of money that you pay for them. And see, that's what you would call a good investment. Now, this is not to say mm-hmm. that the European treat us, you know, like kings. On the contrary, all right. There was immense brutality, all right, and fear, because at the same time, the experience of slavery is nothing that, in this country, is nothing that Africans had experienced in their lifetime. Yes, in fact, yeah, there was what they would call slavery, domestic slavery, and war, and prisoners of war slavery, in which you were captured, and then you would be servitude, all right? But at some time, you would be integrated back into the tribal or ethnic group that conquered you, all right? But it wasn't, mm-hmm. Everything was not passed down to your descendants, all right? And you
right.
and the brutality, did not sustain itself in order to keep you subservient and to draw that fear. So as we get into the black liberation, the church was extremely, people got involved, the Europeans saw that, you know, converting everybody to Christianity was a means of controlling. At the same time, we were smart people, we were still smart, so that as an opportunity to get a little breathing, because, you know, you go to church on Sunday, so you can't hear the word, you know, if you're working. So you gotta get right. some time off.
Mm-hmm.
And see, any opportunity to get some time off, we would take it. In addition to that, contrary to popular belief, it's also because the European was so convinced that he had brainwashed us so badly, those settings, particularly the church settings, was an opportunity to plan and plot, you know,
mm-hmm.
either running away, insurrection, you know, like Nat Turner. I think it was a preacher,
mm-hmm.
all right? So,
right.
you know, it was an opportunity, all right, for us. So this black liberation theology came out of that kind of movement, slavery, and then after the slave trade, you know, the Jim Crow, the convict leasing, all of that stuff, all right? The church was still there, and the preacher commanded a certain degree of respect. When I say respect,
mm-hmm.
again, I don't want people to get off and say, oh, the preacher got respected by white folks. No, it's just that it was the preacher's job to keep the natives in line.
Mm-hmm.
You follow me, sister? All right,
right
that respect
right.
was, all right, boy, keep the Negroes in line. That's your job,
mm-hmm.
all right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, therefore, they commanded a little respect and then leave us to ourselves. But it was out of this movement that we get the talk. Now, what was the initial talk? Well, as we begin to get closer to the Civil War, you had challenges. Well, let me give you this picture, and then people who you know on the call who might have a little bit more information, please call in and inform all of us. But when Columbus came over here, okay, he found out that there were some dark people here.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
There were Africans here before Columbus, all right? Now, they couldn't tell people Africans. The Garifuna and other communities, particularly the Garifuna, who now resides in Honduras and Belize, okay, I claim that they were, in fact, they claim that their language is what they call Arawak. Now, interestingly, Arawak was one of the languages that was spoken in the Caribbean before the European came by the Caribs
mm-hmm.
and the Arawaks, who were supposed to be indigenous to the islands, Caribbean islands,
mm-hmm.
okay?
Right.
All right, so the Garifuna said, that's what we speak. And they'll tell you, they have their language is different. I mean, I've heard them speak. I knew a couple of Garifunas. They spoke there, and it wasn't Spanish. Okay?
Right.
And they
okay.
were they from
okay.
Honduras, so it wasn't Spanish. All right. So we know that there were black people here, and, of course, I believe many of our family members on the call have heard of the Olmec, and they've been here, you know, the Olmec statues in Mexico. All right, these heads, black heads of black folks, you know, that's been there for a thousand or more years, before the birth of Christ, let alone before Columbus. So we knew that there were
exactly.
black people here already. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And in fact, it's a brother. I can't remember his name right now, and please forgive me. He argues that most of the Africans who were enslaved were taken from this continent, you know, as opposed to the, you know, the what it would take for a trip. And because there was too much casualties as a consequence. And now that could be argued. I don't have the information on that. That's his argument. And I haven't, you know, if he has some data, I would take a look at it. But that was his claim,
right.
is that most of the Africans who were enslaved were those who were gotten here. Not that they didn't take slaves from Africans from the continent, because they did. All right. And
right.
A large number of them, which allowed the continent to be easily attacked and defeat it and to bring about a colonialism, you know, as
mm-hmm.
a consequence
mm-hmm.
of the depopulation of certain areas of West Africa. So we knew that had happened. All right, so what you have in America, you have Africans who were here, you have the indigenous population who was here, who intermingled with the African population. And in fact, on a personal note, but interestingly, my mother never told me this, but my aunt, my mother's older sister, said that she was a black Indian. Now,
uh-huh.
okay, well, all right. you black Indian. She was dark complected, all right, and she used to wear her hair in two. It was kinky like black folks, but she used to always wear her hair in two plaits. I thought that was interesting. Uh-huh. All right, so that's what she uh-huh. said. And my mother never raised a question or, countered it.
uh-huh.
So,
uh-huh.
And I never felt the need at the time to investigate it. But I'm saying that I'm just indicating that there were Africans who were here, who had been here before Columbus, okay? Uh-huh. And there were Africans who were brought here as a consequence of the European aggression and war against African people on the continent, all right, and they uh-huh. brought them here, okay, all right, and some of the folks like the Garifunas fought the Europeans, all right, and they had a semi-truce. They would then be, they were on the islands, the Caribbean islands, and then they were taken,
right.
all right, from the Caribbean islands to Honduras and Belize, and developed some cultures there, all right. And that's probably one of the few places where, you know, you see, except the Gullah Geechee groups, all right, that came from mm-hmm. Charleston, Africans that were
right.
brought there and that were made on the islands be able to sustain a large amount of traditional African practices. All right.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm saying all that to say is that when we talk about these movements, all right, during the before the Civil War, up to the Civil War, including the Civil War and after, there was a lot of dynamics of activities happening, all right, in the U.S. The Gullah Geechee who had escaped ran down to Florida and became, along with some of the indigenous population, the Seminoles,
mm-hmm.
all right, and they were Africans, all right. They escaped, all right, and they had their language, all
right,
and right. they mixed their language with the Seminoles. In fact, the Seminoles didn't come on the scene until after the Gullah Geechee left and ran and escaped into Florida, because you know they lived in South Carolina and Georgia. Escaped into Florida mm-hmm. along with the Creek Indians, all right, who were also
okay.
having problems with the Europeans, all right, and so uh-huh. they stayed and fought together and had three wars against the European invaders and never lost.
Okay.
They never lost.
Right.
They had the
exactly.
Europeans had to negotiate. They never lost. All right,
uh-huh.
And it's interesting that a lot of this took place, you know, right after the Haitian Revolution, when they kicked the French behind, as well as the British, all right, who was trying to take
right.
over Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
So all of the dynamics are happening, these wars, and now these freemen who were men, we don't know whether these freemen before the Civil War were from this community of people that I told you that were already here, but they were not mm-hmm. enslaved.
Right.
You hear what I'm saying? All right. They were
uh-huh.
freedmen. Now, after 1865, all black people technically were freemen.
Uh-huh.
All right. They were free men. All right. All right. The 13th
right.
and 14th Amendment, 15th Amendment, you know, were supposed to give them the rights to citizenship, technically, all
uh-huh.
right, that
uh-huh.
the other Europeans were supposed to have. And the other Europeans didn't necessarily have citizenship because they didn't own any land. Not all of the Europeans owned land. These were usually to the property owners, okay? But in order to get the cooperation of the Africans, the European did a trick bag and say, well, look, you help us, you know, particularly during the Civil War, and then we're going to make sure that you're going to be appropriately compensated, all right, give you land, and we'll give you citizenship with the introduction of these amendments to the Constitution. People say,
mm-hmm.
well, why would they do that? All right. And I'll answer from my assessment why they would do that, because who would have the most intelligence in the South? who would have the most incentive, you know, to overcome their
mm-hmm.
condition in the South? All
right.
So the aid had to come from the black people who knew the who knew the plantation, knew where the plantation owners or the soldiers of the planters were.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so they were a very potent, all right, force. So yeah, you got to make
mm-hmm.
a deal. It's just
okay.
that one thing we didn't learn. Although the Native American learned it, the Europeans speak with forked tongue.
Uh-huh.
You can't trust them. So let me
right.
stop here for a minute to see if you want to follow up with any questions or if the family might want to chime in on this discussion.
Well, right now I don't see any hands raised on the board. So I think that it's fair to say you can continue.
Okay, so with the black liberation theology, it was to liberate the theology, and the liberation of that theology was to remove us from that shackle. Now, but we had to continue it because when we got sharecropping, convict mm-hmm. leasing was still tied us to the land, but didn't essentially pay us for the production to produce what was consumed, all right, by people
uh-huh.
in the U.S. All right, and then of course we know the clans and their folks, all right, still were very oppressive, because little as is told, the African population was the majority population in most of the southern states.
Uh-huh.
So you had to be outright cruel in order to try, and plus you had the guns. Africans did not have the
uh-huh.
guns, all right, to do
uh-huh.
that. So the theology was a peaceful movement. I don't say peaceful. It was out of which came, I guess, the King's movement, was to use theology, all right, to justify, all right, convincing Europeans that we are now as equal to the liberties that you enjoyed as a consequence of these amendments to the Constitution that came about. All right. So
okay.
that became our voice. All right. Now, when we found out that the European lied, you couldn't trust him. He didn't give us our
uh-huh.
40 acres and a mule. He gave us hell. He put us when we ran from the south up to the north. All right. He used us. All right, to break up strikes, and so we had the
mm-hmm.
Europeans that didn't, the European workers who didn't like that we were coming from the south working cheaply, all right, and of course, in the south we were majority population until we got thin out, and so we were brutalized as a consequence of just being in plain numbers, and then we were pushing for liberation. We really wasn't pushing so much for liberation as much as we were pushing, all right, to be free and equal, all right? We wanted
right.
to be able to participate like they said that we could.
Uh-huh.
And consequently, they didn't, all right? So the reparation movement had its ancestry right after the Reconstruction period, all right? I'm not going to talk about that, but there is plenty you can, you know, Callie House, you can talk about some of the stuff that she did. Queen Mother Moore, you know, in the 1900s, the work that
mm-hmm.
she did coming out of the Garvey movement, number of people, Fannie Lou Hamer, you know, in the South, the number of things that they did in the reparation movement, and all the reparation movement was, well, look, you promised these things, you didn't, we're still catching hell, all right,
mm-hmm.
you know, we made you wealthy, all right, and yet we had not benefited from the wealth that we created. And the Africans really made this country wealthy. Just in
mm-hmm.
cotton production alone, pre-Civil
mm-hmm.
War, accounted for 60% of U.S. export. That's cotton production alone. Ain't talking about tobacco
right.
and sugar. Cotton alone accounted for 60% of U.S. export, and it also
okay.
accounted for 80% of the European import. So when they had the Civil
mm-hmm.
War, production went down, and consumption went down. A lot of people, you know, like they said during the the Great Depression, people was jumping out of windows. Well, during that time, people were jumping off of ships in Europe because it was 80% of the import. They couldn't get it. And that was, and particularly England, because England was industrializing, and it had its factories, and it used to export to Europe. As the United States, Europe, in fact, the U.S. biggest market for its export material. All right. So,
Brother Sibas,
if you follow me, that's... yes, ma'am.
Can I, before you go on to your next thought, we have someone holding. So,
okay, sure.
I'd like to take this.
Please.
Caller with the last four digits, 3429, please state your name, where you're calling from, and make your comment or ask your question. Thank you.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we
yes.
can hear you.
We can hear you.
Okay, yeah, greetings, and thanks for the program, and I'm enjoying your topic tonight. My name is Lamar, and I'm calling from the Columbus area. And I was just listening, and I just want to make a small correction to your distinction of Friedman and Friedman. The ones that were free, never been enslaved, and that were even the ones that were associated, that were slaves on. With the Indians and that were free there, they were Freeman, Freeman. And I know because I have a great-great-grandmother who bear that last name, and that's where the name comes from. Freedman, Freedman, Freedmen, are the people that were freed after emancipation. So just want to make that small distinction, make sure we know that our audience knew that. I am a reparationist, and so just listening to, you know, just listening to you, you know, just share what you knew, you know, of course, about, you know, of course, you know, what's been, you know, going on from, you know, from some of the early on pioneers. Pleased to hear Pan-Africans acknowledge Cali House, because, I can credit this new reparations movement for that, because I've been in, you know, I became a reparationist when I was in my 20s, about 30 something years ago, almost 30 years. And of course, in Cali, and I only learned about Cali House once I got into this into this latest reparations movement, the lineage based reparations movement. And of course, one thing about Cali House that I found interesting, she predated the Garvey movement. And of course, a lot of the members, strangely though, a lot of the members that were in her organization became Garveyites. She had about 500,000, and a lot of them became Garveyites. You know, of course, there's a lot of, you know, theories, you know, around that. And of course, and just the timing of it and all of that, you know, because there was a lot of opposition to Cali House, especially from the mainstream Boule, you know, just like Garvey had his mainstream Boule detractors. And so so we went from a reparations movement to a back to Africa movement, along with a, you know, equal rights, civil rights kind of movement. So, yeah, we've been doing some deep dives into that. I just wanted to make that clear distinction. I just wanted to, and then you mentioned NCOBRA, which of course, you know, shout out to NCOBRA for, of course, you know, introducing me, you know, to reparations. When I was, you know, in my 20s, I traveled to a conference in Atlanta, and of course, and I got a chance to experience that. But of course, you know, the movement has evolved now, and of course, it's picking up steam, and it's not going away compared to a lot of the movements in the past where, you know, reparations would come out, it would be ridiculed, then it would go away for another 4, 5, 6, 7 years. Somebody will write a book, Randall Robinson will come out, write a book, he'll make the news circuits. Then, you know, that was the book, then it would go away. 2014, Coates came out with his book, made the news circuits. Obama was, I think Obama was either, Obama had came into office. Yeah, he was in office at that time. You know, he kind of ridiculed it, and then, of course, it went away. But this version of the reparations movement, you know, the lineage-based reparations movement here in the United States is here, not going away. And of course, there's a political connection to this movement. Of course, it's you know, we're basically demanding no tangibles, no black agenda, no vote. And this is a leaderless movement for the most part. And it's not going away, and it's having an effect politically. A lot of black faces falling from high places if they're not, you know, if they're not addressing, you know, if the Democrat, if they want to be the face of the Democratic Party, but they're not addressing the issues of their constituents because, you know, their most loyal constituents, which is, you know, which is black Americans. The wealth gap, the motivation of this reparations movement, not, you know, and of course, and we are, you know, anchored. You know, in America, we, you know, we are, of course, we've been here for 500 years now. And, of course, you know, we built this. You know, you were talking about how we picked the cotton. That's so true, all of that. We built this nation's economy. And, of course, and we never got a chance to participate in it, and we just need to be made whole. So I just wanted to stop by, and I'll continue to listen. And, of course, however you want to, you know, choose to engage me or, however the case may be, I'm here listening. So just wanted to chime in and say thank you all for the conversation.
Well, thank you for Brother Lamar. Appreciate your insight and the correction. And I think you did hit upon key points, and which need to really be studied, you know, by our intellects, all right, or scholars. Let me use that term. All right, and that is the period in which Cali House, the Garvey Movement, and Booker T, which were around the same era a little bit, that needs to be really, really studied as the impact of what that had on future movements. But let me jump off into you mentioned in Cobra Inc. and a few others, looking at the evolution of Pan-Africanism and reparations. And what we see coming is a consequence of this plebiscite that I talked about. And in the plebiscite, there were three fundamental questions, and that is, and the brother did mention about the wealth gap, which was included in this, all right? Not explicit, but included. In fact, the evolution of it did make it a little bit more sound, and I'm going to tell you how that goes. Remember I said earlier that the plebiscite associated with reparation dealt with three possibilities of solution, and that one of them was, all right, what I called a complete separation. In other words, people of African descent, black folks in this country, would actually physically separate by having a state, a political structure, a nation state of its own, all right, and that nation state, in other words, these people say that the United States, all right, has not done historically anything to make it believe that it's going to live up to its word. Consequently, we want to separate, okay? Mm-hmm. All right, and we want to separate on the land, well, initially the land that was responsible, all right, for the wealth that you stole, which most of the Black Belt South, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The other expression is that, no, you can keep the land. You just give me resources enough to get the hell out of here. You know, the rematriation that I was telling you about? All right, I want the resources to leave because I know you lie. I can't believe anything that you say. I want the resources to reintegrate, all right, what you stole because you I want the ability to go find out where I left, all right, from, all right, and I want the resources to reintegrate or the resources to immigrate and maybe build up a separate area on the continent. And, of course, the last is for those people, and the people who are, you know, want the wealth guy might fall into, to be whole as a full citizen, then you got to give me back what you stole. You understand what I'm saying? All right, you got to give me back what you stole. All right. So we have what I call three expressions in reparation. That is the separation of here on this territory, here in the Western Hemisphere, the rematriation, get me the hell out of here. I don't believe you. You've never been honest before. And those folks who say, well, look, we can make you honest. We'll stand our chances, but you gotta make good what you stole from our ancestors, and the plight that you subjected us to as a consequence of staying here after 1865. All right, and so the Pebblesite would address that, particularly the independence. This is where the liberation come in, the independence of separation. Or the independence associated with rematriation, okay, leaving and setting up, reintegrating, using your skills, your tools, the resources that you got, because you lied, you're going to pay us back to go back to the continent, all right, or the resources here. Now, the second one of here is sort of like part of the PG, but remember now the PG, R, and A, you know, did look for separation, all right? They wanted separation because they had worked the land, all right, from that area of the country that made the rest of the country extremely wealthy. And so that's where the liberation aspect comes in, it with the Pebblesite, all right, and where the out of the groan of the black theology, where it came out of that, because we were housed in churches and we had an opportunity to discuss what is it that we want, all right. And then until the European caught on to that, and then they begin to pay closer scrutiny to the church. All right. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the things. Now, the liberation movements called for, all right, independence, particularly if you want to separate. They call for self-determination, all right, in addition to that sovereignty of black folks here in the U.S., all right. In other words, it had made a distinction. We don't believe in you. All right. We need you to give back, all right, what you stole from our ancestors. You sound like you had a question, sister.
In a way, I do. I wanted to ask you, it seems that the reparations and the plebiscite depend on legislation from the Congress or from the state legislature. It seems to me that if the government meant to do that, they would have done it by now. So what causes us to have faith in this process?
Very, very good observation. Yeah, the state, to bring about the plebiscite, it has to be voted on, so it has to be set up by the political apparatus. That's your house of your state capital, or of course, the Congress of the U.S. All right, and if you're talking about succession from the U.S., then that has to be taken on a federal level. All right, yeah. So that's a very good observation, a very good point. To me, now this is Shabaka speaking. To me, that presents a slight weaknesses because, as I said earlier. The United States, all right, has not shown, all right, any empathy to address the needs and give up what it stole. In addition to that, even on the UN surface, all right, there are people who are very much involved at the UN level, okay, to bring about a plebiscite, actually to address reparations and the right and the right to succeed as a consequence, all right, of this. And there were some the United Nations on the elimination of racial discrimination, all right, of which the United States was a signature in 1994, but then the Supreme Court says no, we're the true, you can't the Supreme Court now say it was unconstitutional for the United States to sign that. But anyway, that dealt with slavery. It dealt with some aspects of it, dealt with Zionism, you know, dealing with the Palestinian thing. All right. And mm-hmm. so a lot of this stuff now, the weakness that I say is that, you know, looking at the United States has not shown any history. If we look at the UN as a vehicle, all right, to begin to assert that we are a separate people and that we are an oppressed people, an oppressed nationality, I said they've been sort of weak on that too. Well, you say, well, it's the UN. But you remember now, the UN is not a democratic organization. The UN has five, in the Security Council, has five permanent members, four mm-hmm. are Europeans. The other one is Chinese. Okay. All right. And so they're going to use that. They're going to use that forum to protect their interests. And interestingly, what I found out, and this is recent, is that a nation or nation state in the UN, all right, cannot leave the UN.
Mm.
I think I may have mentioned that.
I did not know that.
There is no provision. I haven't seen it. I wish if somebody has that information, please point it out to me. I have not seen it in the UN charter that you can leave. You can be punished, suspended for, you know, not paying your dues or, you know, Security Council vote on this and vote on that. But you're still a member. You can, you know, so you can't leave it. You can't say, I want to get out of it. All right. Now, I think that will be addressed as the future unfolds. But right now, mm-hmm. you can't leave the UN. All right. Now, let me get back to the body of the question, and this is the heart and soul of ULU. You might say, well, how does ULU get in this? ULU's not pushing reparations. No, ULU does see reparations as a just expression, you know, for people of African descent, all right, globally, because mm-hmm. there's nowhere in the world that we have not been touched, you know, by the enslavement, wars, colonialism, and a whole bunch of stuff. So every black person on the face of this right earth has a right, all right, to have its reparations addressed. They may be different because the expression of reparation different from where we are. Like here, right. we were enslaved. Now, mm-hmm. in the Caribbean, all right, our relatives were enslaved too, but they were also colonized because they were the majority population, and they struggled for independence. And as a result of struggling for independence, all right, they had political control, supposedly, of the land of which they were on. Same thing. So they're during the latter part of the 19th century. I mean, the latter part of the 18th century and the 19th century. All right, they resemble very much like Africa. But see, we are unique. The only country that we might resemble to those Africans who are in South America, in which they are not the majority population. So therefore, they are constantly oppressed as a consequence of the low numbers. But even in Brazil, where the Afro-descendant population is the majority, but still it's the white Portuguese-descendant population that controls.
Mm-hmm.
ULU comes in extremely important in this aspect. ULU asserts the right of anybody to push for reparations because it's a just cause, all right, because
mm-hmm.
it's pushing for repair of the injuries. In fact, that's what reparations base word means, to repair the injuries that you created, as well as to compensate us. We are the inheritance of the money that you stole from our ancestors. We want it back. In addition to wanting it back, all right, you have a right to get compensation for injuries, to resolve, to remedy the injuries that you sustained, particularly the psychological injury, the epigenetic injury that has transmitted over generations as a result of fear. What I'm talking about, in some parts of Louisiana, all right, during the 50s, 60s, before they had, while they still having segregation. Some parts of Louisiana, this is what a friend of mine told me, he was from Louisiana. He says, if you touch a white man, you know, accidentally touch him, your skin touch his skin, he could kick your butt. He could beat the hell out of you. All right? If you accidentally touched him. Now, look at the consequence. Look at the consequence of that kind of trauma as you try your best not to touch a white man.
Right.
Can you think of the fear, you know, in your body? It didn't matter what age you were going to, if you touched that white man, he had the option to beat the hell out of you. Okay. And this is what, this is in Louisiana. It might have been, you know, in other parts of the South too. But I just want to give you an idea of the trauma associated, which is epigenetically transmitted to how we respond to certain kind of things and act certain kinds of things here at the present. I want compensation to be treated for that. So you have a right to be able to treat that. Now, what Ulu does, all right, because Ulu is a member of ANCOBRA, and ANCOBRA is a member of Ulu, all right? So we see the dynamics by supporting each other. Our role is to be of self-sufficiency ourselves. We have no intent, you know, to feel a need to have to run to Congress, all right, to beg, but we support the efforts of those who feel a need to do that. And any gains that you make as a consequence of your action empowers us because you're with us. Any gains or action that we make, all right, as a consequence of doing what we're doing, empowers you, all right? And the whole idea, because we bring the economics, we bring the economics to the forum. And once you begin to bring the economics of self-sufficiency to the forum, all right, then you begin to have leverage, all right, in that which you're trying to negotiate. You can't negotiate from a weak position. You have no money, you can't negotiate. You can try to bluff. But you can't negotiate.
Right, for sure.
When we become, and Ulu is the vehicle by which we become an economic powerhouse. That aids the reparation movement. The reparation movement, by its very nature of its demands, all right, aids in our ability to help organize our people within the community and eventually globally. So we being, I think that what you see happening with the reparation movement, all right, the plebiscites, all right, and then how Ulu and ANCOBRA combines to work together, each in its own lane, all right, moving towards liberation, all right, empowers each other. And let me stop here just in case you might want to, you know, address a question.
Yeah, we have a hand up. We do have a hand up.
Okay.
Yeah. Caller with the last four digits, 1249. Please state your name, where you're calling from, make your comment, or ask your question. Thank you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Chris, and I'm calling from Carrollton. And I was listening to the three types of, I guess, outcomes from the reparations. One was rematriation. One was separation, within the country, and then the other was, you know, of course, just being justly repaired and remaining a full best citizen. Now that rematriation is not a new thing; it's been done before. Liberia was one of those examples where, of course, the freed slaves went to Africa, you know, the people in the north, the Quakers. Abolitionist Project, I think that's what it was called.
Quakers.
And, right. And so, and of course, and we see how that worked out over the long haul, but it wasn't an initial failure. It was a great success for a while, but of course, you know, it initially, you know, of course, descended. And then just that and that whole thing about the plebiscite, where we've seen something. Well, first of all, reparations is a federal. If done right, it's supposed to be a federal initiative where the federal government makes, you know, makes amends. But of course, we are seeing some state issues, some state versions of reparations initiated by NCOBRA. And of course, also one also initiated the task force in California. The one in California was, I guess, if you speaking of plebiscite, it was what you call an executive order by the governor. The task force was created, and of course, out of that task force, they came forth with a lineage-based reparation. And so, but reparations itself is federal; is not state. You know, of course, at least the way, you know, is drafted up by some of the major champions of reparations. And I guess I was a little confused when we mentioned that, you know, NCOBRA was a part of that because, you know, you all aren't petitioning the government. But I know that NCOBRA has been heavily involved with, you know, with lobbying the government to for the study of reparations. Matter of fact, they authored, you know, the original and the latest version of H.R. 40. And then the last point that I wanted to make was as we was talking about all of these things, it kind of escapes me. But I guess I can probably just stop right there for now because that fourth point escaped me that I wanted to bring forward. But I did. But the plebiscite and the three forms of reparations, like I said, we've, you know, at least the rematriation has been practiced before. And, of course, and if I think of the fourth one, well, I'll just have to come back another time because I know you all are out of time. So I'll rest there.
Thank you. Thank you for joining
okay.
us.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, brother. You are correct. The initiative that's stating at the state and local level does not say that the that NCOBRA is abandoning its federal push. It was the state, the local and state is to somehow garner up a support to address the national and the local. All right, that's a strategy that it is embarking on right now. We'll see whether that is success. All right, it brings about success. But my cue is that the hookup of NCOBRA and other organizations, which are coalitions forming with more national groups, Pan-African groups, and those groups that are focusing on the economics of self-reliance as opposed to waiting for the government, I think is a good thing because we are sharing information, and where there is sharing, instead of having a fight, you know, ideologically over what's correct, we're saying, well, we'll support your effort to accelerate you in your lane, and you support my effort to accelerate me. It's a win-win situation. And you're right about the Liberian, except the Liberian situation was a colony. It was, when I say rematriation or repatriation, I'm talking about a complete cutoff from the U.S. I ain't talking about, and the people that went to Liberia, I wasn't interested in a cutoff. And I'm saying the necessarily resources to reintegrate in the community that you were separated from. And they use DNA testing and stuff like that to be able to do that and to provide the resources that it can do that. This was an attempt to get rid of some freedmen, all right, and then set up. And, you know, the Congo people, or what they call, that was the original, the descendants of the original people that left the U.S. and went there. And sometimes the indigenous people, they do clash as a consequence of that it wasn't thought out right. And it wasn't supposed to be thought out right. It was a European attempt to see how, in the U.S., to see how it could colonize or have a colony in on the African continent. There in Sierra Leone was a similar example. All right, sister, I think we're running out of time, right?
Yes, we are. And we have no more hands up, so we are clear. Have you Anything else you want to make sure the family knows before we end the night's discussion?
Yeah, well, like the family, if the family is interested in knowing more about the stuff that we're trying to do, all right, we have ULU is we have a nonprofit, we have an LLC, which we'll talk about. If you want to join the effort that we're doing, we want to contribute to building up what we're doing. You can go to the website usliftingus.com. All right, read the material there if you wish to join. We have you know, those links that allow you to be able to join. If you have a question, you know, you can go to info@usliftingus.com and post your question. Sister, do you have the phone number that they can also call? It escapes me right now. Don't worry about it. You can, if you want to.
It's on the website.
So you can.
Let's see.
Right.
How about
404-592-2780.
That's 404-592-2780 to call ULU. And I think what you leave a message is somebody calls you back.
Right. Love to hear from you.
Okay.
All right, peace, sister. Always a pleasure.
Okay. Thank you, Brother Shibaka. We look forward to you coming with some more good news at another time. So we want to thank Brother Shibaka for his discussion this evening. We want to thank everyone who called in and joined us. We want to thank those who listened in and didn't talk. We thank you all for joining us this evening, and we want to invite you to join us again next Thursday evening, also again 9:00 Eastern Time, for another installment of Dare to Win. Peace.